tonight. I'm going to be continuing with the pillar of philosophy. So if you are a regular listener, you'll be well aware I've been covering four different pillars every month as different approaches or ways of how we understand and transmit the Gnostic teachings. So each pillar is just as important as the next, and often they cross over, so it's hard to isolate one as one topic as exclusively to one pillar. But so this week is the pillar of philosophy. So last month I did an introduction on philosophy, what it means, what it is, and why it's important to us as a seeker of knowledge or of truth. So in that program, I also introduced and talked about the Gnostic myth, and this myth, or the different archetypes that are presented in the myth, were originally brought about by the ancient Gnostic masters. So Gnostic masters that existed many, many years ago. So continuing with this theme, I thought I would start to do a study of Gnosticism. And this is a pretty big topic, so it's going to go over a few months. And in a way, it will be like a book study. So the main point of reference material for these talks is from a book called Gnosticism, New Light on the Ancient Tradition of Inner Knowing. And the author is Stefan A. Hweller. And this book was recommended by one of my Gnostic instructors many years ago. It's quite a good book for anyone who's interested in understanding in a global way what Gnosis and Gnosticism are and the difference between the two. So it's not just a, it seems like a mere intellectual parody of information, but he summarizes it pretty well. So let's start with the terms Gnostic and Gnosticism. So both these words are derived from the Greek word gnosis, which loosely translates to knowledge, but a particular type of knowledge that we can or do experience. So people are often more familiar with the term agnostic. Now, this term is actually the opposite of what a Gnostic is. And an agnostic is defined as someone who claims to know nothing about ultimate realities and concerns, and perhaps doesn't really want to have a driving urge to know. Whilst a Gnostic can be defined as a person who seeks salvation by and through knowledge. So through acquiring knowledge and wisdom, one is able to reach salvation. So there's another book called The Gnostic Gospels. This is written by Elaine Pages. And she suggests that the word gnosis should be translated as insight. So instead of being having the meaning of knowledge, that gnosis brings us insight. And this more accurately expresses the type of knowledge that a true seeker is looking for. So a true Gnostic is living for all that which involves an intuitive process that embraces both self-knowledge and knowledge of ultimate divine realities. So this is really what we as Gnostics want to know. Now, what is really interesting about the word gnosis and Gnostic is that they don't actually appear to have been used very much in the first century AD. But Gnostics at that time referred to themselves as either Christian, or if they were in the non-Christian Gnostic category, that fell under Hermeticism, which originated from Hermes Trismegistus. Initially the same type of tradition there. So, however, whatever the different name or form was at the time, back in the ancient Gnostic days, it's said that what's common to all Gnostics or all seekers is that a significant altering of consciousness that transports the knower beyond the limitations of personal consciousness and indeed beyond the limitations of the very world we live in. Now, that's from the book Gnosticism by Hueller. Now, I wanted to add something here that he also talks about in the book, is that Gnostics are not rejectors of the world and rejectors of materialism, because it's interesting in conversations that I've had with people, members of the public who want to know about what the Gnostics are, often have that concept. And really, the Gnostic schools, the teachings are what's called the Fourth Way School. And the Fourth Way School is not about escaping from the circumstances of life. It's about being and integrating in the world, in the material world, but still having that balanced approach to develop internally and to increase our level of being, to be able to transcend the physical circumstances, not to become trapped in matter, for our consciousness to be just think in a very finite sort of way. Also, we stop becoming a victim of circumstances. So I'm not paying so much attention and fascination to the things of the sensations we receive, the senses, the five physical senses, materialism. And so the key to transcending the circumstances is we start to think psychologically, and then we are able to raise our level of being and overcome any difficult circumstances that our life presents to us. But it's not by avoidance. So I just wanted to make that clear and clarify for those who are new to these studies or these teachings that it's working within the circumstances of life. That's where we gain the most wisdom, the most merit, and particularly with the working on the ego, there's a teaching that says that we dissolve the ego in the circumstances in which they were created. So not by ignoring them, by going back there and just not letting the circumstances roll out in a mechanical way to change them at that point. Now, I wanted to talk about how the Gnostics or the ancient Gnostics have been perceived or seen as. Now, if you were to ask a well-researched historian about Gnosis or the ancient Gnostics, they would possibly answer that the Gnostic tradition has become extinct and is only best understood by looking historically at the different texts and teachings. Now, Stephen Hueller, in his book, says the most powerful effort for rehabilitating the Gnostics came from the great psychologist C.G. Jung. And Jung was around or lived between 1875 and 1961. Now, Jung apparently wished to rehabilitate these the myths or the Gnostic myth that was developed and used, along with other myths. So he was very, very into archetypes and symbols. So a lot of his work, is very, very Gnostic in that sense. And because of his use of these myths, it implies that he was influenced by the ancient Gnostic masters like Valentinus, who worked to develop the story of Pistis Sophia and Valentinus' legacy, his disciples and the school that he the Valentinian school. And then Jung uses these archetypes and symbols as a means to understand our psychology. So, because he was a very well-known psychologist, and so he was, in that sense, he was Gnostic in his approach to psychology. Now, according to Hueller's book, Jung insisted that the myths had no metaphysical truth but were purely psychological keys in order to understand our psyche, which is interesting. So perhaps he needed a Gnostic school and a living master to be able to help him understand how those myths translated into not just the psychological realms but in the broader metaphysical and cosmological realms. Now, what's interesting is Hueller in his book doesn't mention the modern Gnostic masters, i.e. the Master Samael Onvior, who, with his partner, Master Litulantes, reignited the modern Gnostic movement that, has sprung many different schools and associations in the world today. And without which I wouldn't be here talking about these teachings. So the Gnostic myth lends itself to allow the interpretation of a symbolic nature rather than a literal interpretation. And it's not exclusively for the use of our psychology. It's just one aspect of using these archetypes and symbols, but also understanding the metaphysical meaning. And we understand these teachings that as above, so below. So if we understand ourselves and our psychology, then we're going to understand the greater world around us and all of creation, because we are a microcosmos, and we're part of a bigger cosmos, but, we understand ourselves and we understand everything else. Now, the Gnostic myth itself, I've gone through already last month, so if we want to know more information on that, then we can listen to that recording on the website, www.gnosticwaves.com. So, before, I'll just go to a music break, but before that, I wanted to read something from the book, which was very interesting. It says, the depths of the Gnostic teachings are likened to an ocean, wherein a small child may wade in the shallows, while a deep sea diver may penetrate into the depths. And this really does summarize the teachings. Someone that goes to the classes and understands it, or only comes to a few classes, might think that it's nothing new. It's just stuff taken from here, there, and everywhere. But really, it takes time to go deeper and to understand the real esoteric truths and path that awakens or opens up to us. So that takes time, and it takes equipment. Like, we need the deep sea diver doesn't go diving just with a snorkel. They need to have the oxygen tank, the special equipment, and they need to be trained. And so without that training, without that time, we're not going to be able to go as deep as someone that's snorkeling on the surface of the water. So hopefully, if we're interested, we are going to find ourselves a local class and attend. Okay, so the first music break is a track called Ave Maria, composed by Schubert and performed by Ingrid Courtesy, Laszlo Kovacs, and Camerata Budapest. Well, I suppose that's the location. Okay, that was a bit of a difficult pronunciation, but nevertheless, here is the track, and we'll be back after to continue on the topic of Gnosticism. Such a beautiful version of the Ave Maria, composed by Schubert. In fact, all the Ave Marias are pretty outstanding. Okay, so we're back on the Gnostic waves and continuing on the topic of Gnosticism and the ancient Gnostics. So most of the historical accounts of the ancient Gnostics were from the point of view of their enemies or adversaries. And, well, they were against the tradition, the Gnostic tradition, and were often considered them as heretical. So, for example, in the 2nd century, Bishop Irenaeus of Lyons was a fierce opponent of the Gnostics and attacked them for their spiritual and literal creativity, accusing them of producing a new gospel every day. So this is because any true Gnostic teaching or school is going to have a balance of tradition and of revelation. So tradition is the teachings that are passed down through the wise masters and sages that have come before us, so that open the door, open the path for us to follow. And the revelation is the actual insight. It's the knowledge or the gnosis that we experience. And we experience this directly through our own work, our own experiences and our own awakenings. And so for that reason, the tradition is going to be adapting to the initiates, to the masters who are working with their insight. But that adaption is never going to be really far out from the tradition. So both are really needed to have a living esoteric school. So if no one is having any insight or revelations, it's just going to become stale and cold and possibly very dogmatic and just a series of rules and morals and possibly fanaticism. But having revelation without any tradition also can cause an unbalanced approach, and without having the framework, without having the guidance of the masters before us, then we can easily fall into mythomania, megalomania. I really like how the Buddhists approach their teachings, or not even just the Buddhists, a lot of traditions. It's from master to disciple, and it's through word of mouth. And for that relationship or that trust to develop, there needs to be a devotion there. So the student is devoted to the teacher, and the teacher is also devoted to the learning of the student. And in that way, their paths are linked. The student is not going to reach self-realization without the master, and the master isn't going to reach self-realization without the student there. That aspect of trust and devotion, which is inherent in all real esoteric schools. Now, actually, on that note, Gnosis, the Gnostic teachings, have been described as a Western form of Buddhism. And in this book, it says that, you know, towards the latter part of last century, 19th century, that people in the West were looking for teachings of the Eastern tradition, because maybe losing a bit of trust in the teachings of West. And so in that respect, the Gnostics are that balance between the Eastern, Oriental, and the Western, the Occidental, I think is the word. Okay, so, well, as written by Hueller, so I'm referencing that book quite a bit, Gnostics were never primarily believers in someone else's gnosis, but were inclined to add to the insights of their founders and teachers through their own experiences. So that's just another way of saying what I was saying before. There's the tradition, that is brought by the master, but through their own insight they build. It's building on that knowledge, so it's not dry stagnation of wisdom. And then he gives a definition of what Gnosticism is. He says, crucially, such a continuing process of gnosis required a conceptual framework in which the new experiences would find their meaningful place. This conceptual framework or worldview within which Gnostic experiences have always found their place became known as Gnosticism. So Gnosticism then is the study of the history of Gnosis, how it's developed, how it originated or as far back as that can be traced, and the different forms it took, the different schools, the different names, which are varied, wide and varied. So he continues, derided and persecuted as heretics, the Gnostics were reduced to a tenuous existence after the first 3 to 4 centuries, yet their teachings and practices have continued to surface throughout the history of Western culture. No sooner are Gnostics and Gnosticism declared defunct than they reappear, changed in form but undiluted in substance. So they may be persecuted, they may have to go underground, become hidden from the mainstream traditions at the time, but always they will reemerge into something new. And because, I mean, knowledge, it just has to be expressed, or there have to be ways for that knowledge to be attained. And without the Gnosticism, then the Gnosis is going to be very difficult to accomplish. And I'm going to talk about that a bit soon tonight. Yeah, so Gnosis and the Gnostic schools have gone under many different names over the ages, but essentially there is the same thread of teachings and the same path of liberation. So with time over the months in these talks, we'll start to explore those that have contributed to what is known as Gnosis and the Gnostic teachings of this day and age. So we'll go to another short music break, and then I'll continue on the topic. And this is Verdi, La Traviata Prelude. So we'll be back in a short while. And you're back on the Gnostic Waves, talking on the study of Gnosticism. So before we go into the practice, I wanted to summarize the different terms and just to clarify some points to help us understand Gnosis and the Gnostic teachings, Gnostic schools. So Gnosis itself is the experience, the insight, the knowledge that we hope to achieve of the things that are a mystery. So things like life after death, or higher beings, or other dimensions, or past lives or future lives, and clairvoyance and faculty. So all of this is the Gnosis, the experience that we have, not just one that we've read about, but one that we have actively seeking. So through meditation, through intuition, by trying to understand our dreams, the symbols or the archetypes, and to be able to interpret our own dreams in light of the knowledge and the path of self-realization. Because our dreams are very useful tools if we know how to use them, or if we learn and train how to remember them and also learn how to interpret them. But we need a lot of intuition and time to do that. So that's a Gnosis we want to experience. A Gnostic, you could say, is someone that is trying actively to experience that knowledge. Now, I would also define Gnostic as someone that puts the pursuit of this type of knowledge at the forefront of their life. So something that they, you know, need to act on. It niggles at them, at their consciousness, in the back of their mind or in their heart. There's always like a restlessness until that pursuit or that knowing is fulfilled, or at least is starting to be fulfilled. So people that are seeking, going from different school to school and really trying to learn. Also, people might be not even be going to different schools. They might just be going from one social group to another social group, or always changing things. But really what they're lacking is that truth, that gnosis, that experience of what is real in life and not just what is false or temporary, you know, something that has real substance and meaning. So that's a Gnostic person. And as Hoyle described in his book, one that seeks salvation through knowledge, so through gnosis. So Gnosticism then is the framework or the tradition that helps us to achieve the gnosis. And so one could say that anywhere that is conducive to experiencing that inner truth is, you know, part of the Gnosticism. So it incorporates the teachings that help us and encourage us to experience the gnosis and incorporate it into our life. It can be the intellectual aspect, so the teachings that we learn intellectually through the different doctrines and the different, you know, apocryphal gospels. And it also incorporates the different groups that existed under the banner of Gnosis, or you know, different, you know, for example, the Hermetic schools, the Rosicrucians, the Freemasons, the Cathars, the Templars. They all were Gnostic, and so, you know, they are contributing to spreading the tradition of the Gnosis. So that's Gnosticism. Now, the Gnostic school is also providing us with a framework to have the experience of Gnosis. And so whilst it's great to talk about Gnosticism in the past and the ancient Gnostics, you know, in early Christianity, it's also really important to talk about the current day modern Gnostic school, which from the Gnostic society that I come from or represent, was originally founded by the Master Samael on Vior. And now that his physical body disincarnated quite a while ago, you know, it's run by the international coordinators of the school, and through that framework, through that order and structure, these teachings have an avenue to be expressed. And, you know, it's through a school, an esoteric school, that people are welcome to join and welcome to stay and work towards developing their own gnosis. And so a lot of people come to the school and come for a bit and then leave again, and may still think or consider themselves to be a Gnostic, and perhaps that is true. A Gnostic is not necessarily one that goes to a Gnostic school. So we can experience that if we're meditating and we're doing the inner work, we're working to develop our intuition, to think psychologically, to interpret our dreams, then we all have the capacity to develop the gnosis within us. But there are many good reasons why one would want to go to a school. And definitely if you're interested in the studies, I would recommend to find one. This show is generally providing quite quite shallow information. It's giving us a taste for what Gnosis is about, but the real depth of the teachings, if we want to be that deep sea diver into the waters of the mysteries, then we need to try and find a school. And if not, hopefully if we're doing the work and we're really dedicated, sincere students, then perhaps that can attract a group to be opening near us, or finding a school that is seriously devoted to the mysteries, which don't just come under the banner of Gnostic. It can be in a variety of different names, the main keys being that the three factors of the revolution of the consciousness, which we've talked about many times. And they are the key factors for a serious Gnostic school, or esoteric school, should I say. So, but reasons why one would participate in a school. So firstly, it keeps us in line with a tradition. So each school obviously is going to have a master or an initiate that's working already and has paved the way to make the path a bit easier for us to go. So it's not like we're pioneering the path. Well, it would be difficult to pioneer one at this stage because so many masters have done it for us. So another benefit is that it keeps our discipline up. So often we have good intentions to meditate, to practice every day, and life just gets in the way and our good intentions get swept away along with our inner work and our inner being. So when we go to a class regularly, it keeps that discipline maintained. And we need that in this day and age when our society, the culture is not pro awakening consciousness. It's not pro spirituality. It's anti-spirituality, you could say. So another really important factor is, maybe it doesn't help you, but I'm pretty sure it helps the other people in the group. So when people all come together, they help one another. They're sharing. The work that we bring in our own meditation is going to help the group energies. So if, I don't know if you've ever been to a meditation class, if everyone's fidgeting and not able to concentrate, it actually impacts on the other people. And so the better our work is, the more we can help other people and to bring strength to the group, like a vortex. So by doing that, we are able to share the work together. So sharing experiences, talking about things, it can be difficult to find people to talk to about the mysteries of life, you know, without thinking like you're strange. So in theory, a group is also a supportive environment. Some may not be. That's why I said in theory, people are there to help us. Sometimes it can be a real gymnasium, actually, like all other circumstances in life when there's people that perhaps we don't get along with, our personality clashes, and it's going to create conflict. I mean, this is also a good thing. We start to learn what comes up in those conflicts, what are the egos that are present, that are interacting with the other person, and trying to work through it. So that gymnasium is really important, and let's face it, it happens everywhere, not just in the meditation or spiritual classes. And then the last point is that when we work together esoterically, it provides a point of light. So when we do the work, we become a point of light for other people. And then before we go into the meditation, I wanted to read something from this book by Hueller, Gnosticism. And I really, really like this passage. I'll read it first. He says, One of the oldest and grandest inducements to philosophical thought and mystical insights is the mystery of the night sky. So long before astronomy told us what was in our sky and how big everything is and how far away everything is, men and women looked up at the dark. I imagine this was before light pollution made it more difficult to see the stars. Men and women looked at the dark, star-encrusted vault of the heavens and drew inspiration from that vision. And I definitely relate to that. Whenever I have the opportunity to look up at the night sky out in the country where there's no light pollution, the moon is not so full, you see all the stars and it's just mind-blowing. And then when you start to learn just how far away these beams of light are, and you just think, wow, how massive the universe is, and it really awakens something in our essence to want to know more about this world that we live in. And, well, we think it's all out there, but really we start within us, inside of us. And this analogy of the dark night is like the veil, and these stars are like cracks in the veil. So we start to see the light. So these cracks, which are the stars, are nothing compared to the immensity of light that we are able to awaken. So we are like, when we do this work, we are like those points of light that the stars are. And the more we work, the more we are going to shine, and then to be able to help each other in this world that we live in.